Checkerfin.
Fordham is always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly
sex,
show.
Sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
in your face, in your face,
your
face.
Listen to your word that they be preaching, cause here's the
Checkerfin.
Education gadfly show. Yeah. It's the Checkerfin. Education gadfly show.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, joining us via telephone, the didactic Rick Hess.
Hey, Mikey.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm doing good. I'm up here in sunny Cambridge.
So, sunny Cambridge, you just had your first class for your gig up there with the Harvard Ed School, right?
I did. It was they had what they call their shopping period, which I'd completely forgotten about since my own student days were so long ago, but I stood around and kind of chatted for 30 or 40 minutes about the things that I would kind of fail to communicate to my class this semester. And we did two little shifts of it, and folks came and sat and asked some questions about, is this actually worth my time? And I tried to convince them that, well, I don't really know.
So this is a market-based approach. I like this.
Yes, it is. it's the ironic, right? I mean, it's funny that, like, they take that as kind of the natural way that folks ought to attract students, is that there really ought to be this kind of transaction-based assumption.
Right. Well, I've assumed that all those little kiddos up there at Harvard said, of course I'm going to take this guy's class. He's got an op-ed in the Washington Post.
I got to say, I don't think a lot of people in Boston or Harvard actually read the Post, so probably not as much impact as it might have had.
So nice op-ed. It was about Michelle Rhee, but it was kind of a love poem to Michelle Rhee. I mean, I thought you're Mr. Skepticism. I don't think anything works. What was that?
The thing is that Michelle, did you see she's been getting beat up in the Washington Examiner? These parent groups are all saying, oh, well, maybe she's trying to fix, you know, central administration, or they can't tell whether or not a teacher's been fired. But what's she doing about Susie's classroom getting better?
All right.
And, I thought it was appropriate to just try to say, wait a minute, that you can't fix everything at once. And, you and I have talked about this a little bit in other occasions. It's, you know, we don't know exactly what's going on. But, you know, from where I'm sitting, it looks like she and Fenty have got the priorities right. And so I wanted to remind folks that, you know, that the fact that the superintendent isn't micromanaging your kid's classroom is not a good reflection of whether or not she's off to a good start.
All right. Well, listeners, if you think that Rick has a big crush on Michelle Rhee, send us a letter.
Well, that's a given, baby. Come on now.
At letters@edexcellence.net. We would love to hear from you. All right, let's get going. We're going to play a game of Pardon the Gadfly. We've got a great interview today with Kate Walsh from the National Council on Teacher Equality. And finally, Liam will impart some education news of the weird. All right, ooh. Christina, kick us off.
All right. 8 inner-city Washington, D.C. Catholic schools are going charter. Is this good for Catholic schools, the charter school movement?
It is good for the charter school movement, and that these seem to be pretty effective schools, and they will now be charters. It's bad for Catholic schooling, since these are apparently pretty decent Catholic schools that will no longer be Catholic schools.
Very succinct, Rick. I like that. Yeah, I think that's about right. You know, we've called for religious charter schools for a long time here at the Fordham Foundation. You know, there's all this concern about church-state lines. You know, other countries in Europe don't worry about that in quite the same way. You know, we don't understand why these Catholic schools can't stay Catholic and still be charter as long as they're willing to be held accountable for student achievement.
You know, I mean, one of the interesting things there is that's right. You know, the U.S., which is, you know, by many metrics, kind of the most religious country in the world, and you know, the least regulated of the major Western democracies, is the most uptight about the church-state divide when it comes to schooling. You know, you look at the Netherlands, you look at Belgium, government, you know, even France, many cases government treats religious schools more or less the same way it treats non-religious schools when it comes to funding and regulation and such. The flip side of this, of course, is that in those countries, religious schools are overseen and regulated by government in a whole bunch of ways that the American religious school community would probably, you know, be incredibly unhappy with.
Yeah.
So there's always kind of this trade-off here of, if you're going to take public money, how are you going to draw those lines?
Right. And it certainly bodes ill for the Catholic school movement. You know, a lot of people thought that Washington, D.C. was doing everything right, had a voucher program. The archdiocese seemed to be very reform-minded, put some resources into improving these schools. And even here in D.C., you see that these schools are going to have to close because there's just not the financial resources to keep them afloat.
Yeah, I mean, right, and that's the real shame, that here we are, it's not like urban communities are awash in good and effective institutions, schools or anything else. So the idea that, you know, some of these institutions that, you know, are really linchpin to the community and appear to be doing pretty well, but they've got to make these kinds of tough choices.
Right.
That's not, it's not ideal from anybody's perspective.
Okay.
Next topic. When reauthorizing NCLB, which would be the bigger sin? Being so prescriptive that well-meaning states aren't able to develop logical accountability systems, or being so flexible that ill-meaning states make Swiss cheese out of accountability?
Well, Christina, that's a difficult question. You know, there is a way out of this solution. And you know what it is, Rick?
What's that, Mike?
National testing. You know, I testified the other day on Capitol Hill. I made the point, look, if
you... Did you? Who did you testify before,
in
Mike?
In front of George Miller, Chairman George Miller and his House Education Labor Committee.
Did they say nice things about you?
No, in fact, there was a representative from Kentucky that said some very mean things about me because I argued that if they really cared about having a watertight accountability system, and if they're... allies and the civil rights and business groups and the administration really cared, they would be calling for national testing.
Who was the representative from Kentucky?
He was, Christina, help me out. Yeah.
Yarmouth? Maybe?
Representative Yarmouth, yes.
Ah, and, you know, well, because this way your faithful listeners can send an email saying, please don't pick on our Mike Petrilli.
Yeah, he was tough. And, it's a testimony. I didn't get a chance to respond because he did not ask me a question.
Did you say watertight in your testimony?
I did say watertight.
That's a nice metaphor. You don't get watertight very much in accountability debates.
Yeah. And so if you want it to be watertight, if you want there to be no way for states to play games, the only way to do that is to have a national accountability system with national standards, national tests, national school ratings, the whole shebang. They obviously don't want to do that. They are left with this dilemma where they, if they get too prescriptive, they're going to keep some states from doing good things.
Well, but even if you do that, so long as you bright line 2014 and 100%, you have a national system, but then all you do is replicate this exact same dilemma in Washington, D.C. instead of in 50 state capitals.
Well, that's exactly right, Rick. And that was the one thing I said is, look, if you're going to give states this authority, some states are going to do well, some states are. Just at least remove the perverse incentives that are pushing states to do the wrong things, like that 2014 deadline and the 100% proficiency requirement.
Mm. So aren't you then really just endorsing the Suburban Schools Relief Act?
No, not exactly. But we can talk more about that some other time.
Now, Mike, was it you who did you actually coin that phrase, or did you just take it into the mainstream from somebody else?
No, I coined it.
Dude, you are just a phrase coining machine.
Well, thanks, Rick. I really appreciate it. I can't do much else good around here, but I will say we have a cover of a report coming out that's fantastic. We'll talk about that next week.
A cover of a report?
This is what I can take pride in, Rick. I don't actually have an influence on public policy, but I can coin phrases and come up with clever cover ideas.
Did you draw the cover?
No, we have a designer that drew the cover. It's
you
killer.
You oversaw the designer who drew it.
Exactly.
Does this mean whoever it was that financed like Botticelli is actually responsible for...
Well, if it was the other person's concept, yeah.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Kobe, for saving us. Okay, Christine.
All right. A new evaluation on the National Board says its teachers aren't any more effective than other teachers. What to make of all this conflicting research?
I don't actually know that there's that much conflicting research. The most optimistic accounts, I guess, that the National Board points to right now is, say, the Goldhaber study about 2 years ago, which found about a 7%, in effect that they were about 6 or 7% more effective in the out years, but no more effective in the year they were selected. But if you can't identify teachers who are 6 or 7% more effective in ways that don't require a year of effort in a box of materials, it strikes me that you're probably doing something wrong in the first place.
Yeah.
I think this takes us back to where we've always been, that we all know that there are more and less effective teachers, and that I absolutely agree with those who say that value-added metrics just in grade 3 to 8 reading and math are not useful, should not be determinative of deciding who is a good and bad teacher. But the reification of the National Board has always seemed to me a little problematic.
Whew, that was a big word, reification.
Oof, there you go, baby.
Yeah, this latest research that we've focused on in the Gadfly, which I guess is a little bit old, it's back from the spring, but we weren't aware of it until now. It actually does say that the National Board teachers are a little bit more effective, but they seem to be less effective after they get certified, which is interesting. And in math, at least, they were no more effective in teaching poor kids than non-certified teachers were. They were a lot more effective teaching high-performing kids. So there may be something about the national board process that is identifying teachers who are very good at the upper end of the spectrum but not so good at the lower end.
Right, and that's always been a concern, right? That the kinds of teachers, the kinds of districts that are willing to underwrite teachers to pay, you know, the application fee,
yeah,
and the kinds of teachers who are going to pull together, you know, the box of materials and spend, you know, the March writing up, you know, their 15-page essays and collecting the student portfolios, have always been teachers who are much more likely to be working in your Montgomery counties than in your Norks or your Trentons.
Okay.
And, you know, and the system has always seemed geared to that kind of teaching
right,
model.
Right, right, absolutely. All right, well, that is all the time we have. Thank you, Christina. Rick, we got to keep on a schedule here. I tell you, you're up at Harvard.
Well, you do it. Right, 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 baby.
You're
okay.
You sound like a you know, hot air full of, a professor full of hot air. That's what I meant to say.
That's the problem.
A windy professor.
You step into the classroom and you lose your ability to speak in two-syllable words.
You're a windy professor. Okay.
At least I do. Do I sound windy today?
But you know who does not sound windy? Kate Walsh. Let's listen to our interview with her right now. Joining us today on the Education Gadfly Show is Kate Walsh, president of the National Council on Teacher Quality. Kate, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, Kate, you have an editorial this week in the Education Gadfly, which takes on, Chairman George Miller, Ranking Member Buck McKeon, Education Trust, Paul Hill, Marguerite Rosa, many, many other people, even perhaps myself, who have argued for reform around a part of No Child Left Behind called the comparability provision. Now, let me describe this for our listeners, and you tell me if I get this right. For a long time, Title I rules have required that districts allocate the same resources to Title I schools as to non-Title I schools, so poor schools as to more affluent schools, before the federal money arrives, so that the federal money would be considered extra for the Title I schools. But there's a loophole in current law that allows districts to ignore the actual salaries of teachers. So they could pretend that as long as similarly sized schools have the same number of teachers, they have comparable resources, even if one school has all rookies making $30,000 a year and another school has all veterans making $60,000 a year. Those schools could still be considered to have comparable resources. This new draft bill out of the House would change that and would say that, no, you actually have to make sure that those schools are getting the same amount of money. You think this is a bad idea? Why is that?
Well, I think it's an incredibly bad idea because it's premised on a false proxy that is equating the amount a teacher gets paid with the quality or value that they provide a school. And there's not a study or there's not a bit of information to support such a theory.
Okay, but this has an instinctual appeal, because what we're saying is,
oh, yeah,
is that every school should get equal resources. And right now, Title I schools, poor schools, are getting less money than other schools. This is part of our idea of weighted student funding, money following the child. So, you know, why not just give that money, you know, give equal money to the schools, and if one school, you know, then schools can decide what kind of mix of teachers they want to have.
Well, you're mixing up the question here. You're saying schools should all get the same amount of money, then they should be able to go out and buy the teachers that they want, and that I would agree with entirely. But what in effect happens is schools get assigned a certain number of teachers, and the fact that one principal pays $45,000. For a teacher and another principal has to pay $80,000 for a teacher, there is nothing that says that $80,000 teacher is, in fact, more effective or more desirable. In fact, that principal might love to have that teacher that costs $45,000 a year. So it's not a matter of assigning an amount of money to a school. It's a matter of how schools currently budget teachers.
All right, so let's spin this out a little bit. What are you worried about? You've got a school, let's say, that's trying to make strides. They've hired a lot of young, energetic teachers, maybe from Teach for America. What are you afraid is going to happen to that school?
I'm not just afraid it's going to happen. I know it's going to happen. What districts will do is they'll go in and even out the amount of salaries in a school to make them all equitable for reasons that have no bearing on how much students are learning. So they'll go into a school and they'll say to Principal Jones, you've got your payroll's too low we need to make sure your payroll's a bit higher. So what we're going to do is transfer out these two young teachers you have over here, and we're going to bring in the decrepit old has-beens down the street, and we'll meet federal Title I requirements. And the principal will say, I don't want to lose my great young teachers. And the district will say, too bad. We've got to meet federal Title I requirements. So that's how it's going to work. There's no question. This district is not going to come up with the cash to pay off that teacher to make sure that they get equitable resources. Districts don't have spare cash sitting around. They'll have to do it through salaries.
Okay, so you are afraid there's going to be a great reshuffling, and not in the good way, that we're going to see older lemon teachers being sent to these Title I schools, and it's going to just wreak havoc. It's interesting. Is there any way to get to the goals of equity and equal resources without leading to this perverse consequence?
Well, I'm sure the Congress thinks it will do so in saying that transfers aren't allowed. I know that's what the Aspen Institute did when it did its NCLB recommendations. They said, well, you can't equalize things by transferring teachers. There is no paper trail on teacher transfers. School districts will say, oh, no, we didn't do it to meet federal Title I. We did it because this teacher was needed over here. There'll be no transparency to this, and it will be, in fact, the only way schools can balance their budgets and equalize resources. So I have gone round and round with policymakers on this issue, and no one has come up with a solution to it that makes any sense, because it's based on a fundamental misunderstanding or a flaw that says experience equals quality, and it doesn't. So there's nothing that says more affluent schools are getting more value for their money.
Well, fair point, Kate. I think this is something that our listeners need to hear, that perhaps we're going to see some real unintended consequences. And someday people might see that you are a prophet on this particular point. All right, Kate. Well, thank you for joining us on the show today. Hope you come back. Kate Walsh from the National Council on Teacher Quality.
Thanks, Mike.
What do you think, Rick? So she makes a pretty compelling case that maybe this comparability reform stuff isn't all it's cracked up to be.
I think she raises really good points. And you're right, she is unwindy as all get out.
Uh-huh. She is to the point.
She is concise. She is hard-hitting. And she is easy on the eyes.
You have said that before, Rick. Rick has a crush on Michelle Rhee and on Kate Walsh. The chicken wings that you had last night.
It's true. We're surrounded by pretty cool women.
This is true. All right, Rick. It is time for everybody's favorite. That's right. Education News of the Weird with our special weird correspondent, Liam. Liam, what's weird this week?
Jonathan Kozel has gone on a partial hunger strike.
Ooh.
To protest the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. He's entering the 70th day of subsisting on mostly liquid foods. When his stomach hurts, however, Kozel is allowed to eat real food. Doctor's orders, apparently. Kozel has lost 29 pounds since beginning the strike. And at the rate NCLB reauthorization is progressing, one suspects he'll lose far more weight than that.
Did you have to turn the page there, Liam, or what happened?
No, that was, it was a stylistic thing.
Far more weight? Is that the way you do it on your NPR show?
Sometimes.
Okay, that sounds very NPR. It sounds like that woman with the scratchy voice.
And that's Education News of the Weird.
All right, Rick. So Jonathan Kozel has gone on a diet to protest No Child Left Behind. I want to know, what are you willing to do to protest what you don't like about No Child Left Behind? I'm going to challenge you, Rick, to go on a partial drinking strike. Okay? The next time you go into happy hour and you think about drinking 10 beers, I want you to only drink 9 beers.
Well, and then I'm only going to have the 10th if I think my stomach's hurting.
That's right. And you need it for subsistence. Well, are you willing to do this, Rick?
What is he protesting exactly? So is Jonathan Kozol opposed to Title I and the old ESEA architecture, and he says, by God, he wants to end every nickel of federal funding to education?
I think he's opposed to the reign of terror that No Child Left Behind has wrought on urban classrooms where children are just tested from dawn till dusk.
You know, because I mean, this could be the first time in history that somebody has launched a partial hunger strike, also I guess known as a diet, to protest some partial language which modifies an extensive standing statute. I mean, this is Jonathan Kozol is bringing a whole new meaning to kind of, you know, legislative authorization deliberation. Good for him.
Yeah, I mean,
how's that, Mike?
A lot of
syllables right there, baby.
I like it.
He also has a new book out, though.
Yes, Letters to a, you know, not very bright teacher.
Right.
I think his next book is going to be a diet book.
the Kozol diet.
The Kozol diet. I mean, this is whatever he's doing is working. Yeah.
Have you seen his book, or they did an excerpt in Fight Out the Captain. Have you read this stuff?
No, I don't read the Captain.
It's priceless.
But back to this diet book idea, I think it could be a big seller because, as we've discussed before, there is definitely an obesity epidemic among the teaching ranks in America.
Mm.
So
do we have stats on that, or is this just an offensive observation?
This is purely an offensive anecdote that I'm throwing out there. But come on, have you been in a school lately? I mean, I don't have scientific proof, but I think there's a real problem out there.
Why are you getting this?
Are you not backing me up on this?
Look,
I'm just saying it's not their fault. You know, they've got an impossible schedule. They, you know, a lot of teachers, you know, you hear teachers say, look, they get to 3 o'clock, they're exhausted, frustrated. What do? They grab a bag of chips.
Oh my God, now you're backpedaling from offensive to like sycophantic.
I'm just saying, a diet book for teachers, I think, could do well on the market. Especially if Jonathan Kozol wrote it.
Yeah, but if he throws in a little bit of tantric yoga, he could pitch it to these urban kids too who are overtested.
All right. Well, people here are saying I should stop before I completely lose any credibility with our target audience, which I'm happy to do. Rick, thanks for joining us from Cambridge.
Hey, my pleasure, babe.
All right. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.